There's sometimes when that poverty is not a result of one's lack of labor or whatever else. But a lack of labor, a lack of doing anything, and just being one who's lazy is going to get you there for sure. That's going to be something that will, in the end, bring the person to himself. And it'll also cause them to envy other people. Because they're not willing to work themselves. They look at what the other has, and they want to get that for themselves without having to do that work. And here's what Solomon is noting. Now, what's the solution to that? Here's the one side where you have that power and that wealth, you're oppressive. Here's the other side, you're lazy, you won't work, and the result of it is you don't have anything. Better what? A handful with quietness than both hands full, together with toil and grasping for the wind. What does that mean?
Work, be happy with what you got.
Okay.
And don't be grasping for everything, because it's going to wear you out.
When you do grasp for everything, and we're going to get into that as it goes on, too. This is going to continue. And what's going to happen? You're not going to be content with what you have. And the more you gain, are you going to be content with that? But what will it produce? More for you to worry about. And there's a sense of a recognition of what this is for. Instead of being one who is always trying to amass more and more and more just to get more. The point is, you need to have the handful, what's necessary for you to get by and be happy with that and thankful for it. Go ahead. I saw it, and I don't think that's the best way to put that. It's an idiom that is not normally taken in that way as coming from or coming out of. But it could be that they've got something there. But I think the idea is here of how you look at these two and put them in contrast. Again, there's a moderation in these things of life that we're getting to. And this is going to be brought up more and more as we go. Anything else there? Go ahead. God.
If you want to be miserable in life, be jealous and envious. Because you're not just, typically most people aren't just like jealous or envious of one person or one thing. I mean, they're jealous and envious of everybody, you know, and it will eat you up like a cancer and make you miserable.
It will, and it'll divide a people. And we see a lot of that today. And the point of it is, this is an effort. Instead of trying to be the one that's on top, you've got people who look at their oppression and they blame other people who didn't cause their oppression. And so now I'm entitled to get what you have because sometime in the past, somebody you were related to oppressed somebody I was related to, and now what happened? Now you turn the oppression around the other direction. That's not going to do any good because you're just going to get it on the other end as well. The idea is of recognizing there are always going to be those who have more. There's always going to be those who have less. There are always going to be those who have more skill. There are always going to be those who have less. Learn to deal with what you've got and do that with joy and be thankful for it. And then you've done what you need to do. The ideas of what are presented here go on then in verse 7. Then I returned and saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone, without companion. He has neither son nor brother, yet there is no end to all his labors. Nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. You notice this part right here is italic. What does that mean? That's added. It's added to give a sense, as the translator thinks, it's intended to be done. I'm not sure that it does or it doesn't. There are two ways to look at that. But overall, the point is obvious. When you're out here and you see that there is one that is alone, somebody that doesn't have anybody else, there's no companion, what's the problem with that?
No one to share it with.
Okay. What else? Why is this tied? There's one alone without companion. He has neither son nor brother. Yet there is no end to his labor, nor is his eye satisfied with riches.
This is somebody who doesn't have a lot of people to provide for, and yet he still is consumed with kingdom.
And what's the name of the game to him?
War.
All right. Man that dies with most toys, he wins, is the idea here. You get more and more and more for yourself. Why? But he's not doing that to help somebody else. He doesn't have any companion. He's doing that. Here he is with no one to provide for or no one to work with. And he uses his time to get more and more and amass that wealth or amass these things. Why? Because that's what he thinks is going to bring his satisfaction. But what's happening? Does it bring that satisfaction? No. What does it do instead? Typically, it consumes him, typically becoming more and more bitter, more and more one who is dissatisfied. I thought this would do it, but it doesn't. And now there is that kind of a way. Now when he's like that and has gotten to that point where he's in that kind of a bitterness or whatever, is he likely to have a companion that wants to be around him? The very thing that would help him is the thing that he's going to drive away by the way that he is. And so we point out the fact that when here is this one and they decide, I'm going to go out and I'm going to get more and more and more, that greed for self, acquiring for self, is going to do the very thing that is going to drive him further into that and keep him away from someone who might be a companion. How might he handle that differently and have a better outcome?
Be satisfied with a handful.
Okay.
Pursue the things in life that are important. It's almost like the storyline for Christmas Carol.
Yeah, okay. I think of the rich young ruler here. Here he had great wealth. Jesus said to him, one thing you lack, go sell what you've got, give it to the poor, and come follow me. There's two parts in that. We only notice one many times, and that is sell what you have and give to the poor. And number one, that's done something for somebody else. When we assist others, when we serve others, does that tend to make us have that better sense of joy and contentment and purpose in life? Yes. Second is, you come follow me. You take up your cross and follow me. The point is there, you need to have a greater purpose in your life. And so both of those put together, here I think is the same idea with this guy. He doesn't have a companion, and as a result of that, he's coming to be self-absorbed. And what happens? That doesn't bring him any satisfaction. That draws him further into what he was. Now, the last point of it is that, but he never asked, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? In other words, what am I doing this for? That rich young ruler that was getting more and more and more and not helping others, or the one that's the rich, pull down my barns, build greater, I'll have things for many years, take, eat, be merry. He was self-absorbed. What if that's used in a proper way to go out and help others the way that we need to? There wouldn't have been the need for all of those things to be done of the building of the new barns. It could have been put to use, and a good use at that. Go ahead, Jeff.
Instead of on the flesh, but chapter 5, you know, those who are of the flesh.
get a quarterly report on your 401k or whatever, but we need to put a quarterly report on our soul and the treasures laid up in heaven. Go ahead. First, provide for your own, and then have some to provide for others, and that needs to be the concept that's here. When it's put into self, he says, this also is vanity and a grave misfortune. That kind of a guy who lives in that sort of a way is going to be one who never has a contentment in this life at all. Jesus spent a great deal of time talking about that. When you go through the Proverbs, there's a good deal of time spent on that. In the book of Ecclesiastes, this is already the second time that we've come up with this, and we'll have three more. So it's obvious that we need to take a bit of care and inventory with regard to what is our concern on. And when we have such one-sided concern that it's in this world and consumingly in this world, and not with regard to our eternity before God, something's wrong. And we need to make a very big change. Go ahead, Larry. I remember my mom and dad helped an old woman who had never married, didn't have any children, obviously, was just by herself, and she was always consumed with what she was going to have for this and getting something, acquiring more for herself, came to be somewhat of a hoarder, I guess is what we'd call it now. But the idea of it was the very life that she lived, self-consumed, and nobody wanted to be around her, you know. And it's it was that idea, I got to take care of myself. Well, you've got to help somebody else. There's a part of life that will, I think, make us very clear, if we are not servants of others, then we're never going to understand the contentment that life can bring. We understand that as parents, it's a lot more blessed to give than to receive. Paul talked about that Jesus had said. We all recognize that to our kids. We'd rather give them something than get something for us. And we have to recognize that in life as a whole as well. It isn't about just amassing for ourselves and building up a big wealth cushion. All right, let's go to verse 9. Two are better than one. He continues on with this point, but with a different twist. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion, but woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Although one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. All right. That idea of how it is that there is a blessing in companionship. Why is there a blessing in companionship? What's the good from it?
One falls, the other picks him up.
Okay. Is that it, just in case you fall? Is that the point of this?
Support.
Okay. All right, when you've got that, they're there together. They're there to share the load. That's something that you read about a lot in the New Testament as well, not only with regard to what we do in bearing one another's burdens, but in talking about the home as well, husband and wife. That there are those things where there's a share of that. It's not just physical in its nature. I think most of the time when people get married in their newly married state, they're looking at that kind of thing. We're together. We have that physical union. There is all of that that's there. All of the things of being together in a way of the various parts of our life that we find fulfillment. But what do you get to thinking about when you're well on up in years? And, you know, having a tennis partner doesn't matter a whole lot anymore. All of these kind of things. What's the point of wanting that companion? All right. You've come to be together in a sense that there's a mutual dependence. There's a sharing. You look at people who have a good marriage, and what's happened is a lot of times they're opposites to start, or they've taken different routes, and what happens is they take the gap the other one hasn't filled yet, and they work together in that sort of a way, and it makes it a greater life. One of the things that I think anybody who's been married very long at all recognizes is the association that you have, the give and take, the talking. And that's one of the things that widows and widowers are lacking the most, that they miss, is that ability to talk things over and that kind of a part that the other one plays. We've each had a role here, and that's to kind of help together in all of those things. When you don't have that, these other points are made not really of that being the specific statement itself, the point itself. It's not that if one falls, the other one can pick him up, or if they lie down together, they can't be warm. They provide that warmth that's there. That's a kind of an illustration of what? How it takes both parts of that. You have the man and the woman. Look back to the beginning. Genesis chapter 2. Why is it that God made the woman? What did he tell Adam? It's not good that man should be alone. So what did he make? A help meet for him. In other words, a helper that suited what he was lacking. God knew what a man was like. And when you look at men, there is a difference, a uniqueness. I know that's something that many in our world seem to object to, but it's pretty obvious if they'd open their eyes that there's a difference between men and women. There's a difference physically. There's a difference mentally. There's a difference in outlook. And what happens when you're married? You before have been looking at it only from one standpoint, only one part of that, and you're missing that other. And what happens? Here comes in the complement of that. The helper meet for him. What the man was missing, the woman provided. But that also says what? What the woman had that God made her with did what? She's missing what that man had. And she needs that as well. Now, are there cases where someone is going to be alone through their life and celibate and bachelor or someone who is forever unmarried woman? Yeah, that may be. But that isn't the norm. The norm is that there is a fullness that comes, a unity that's reached, a oneness when they're joined together because they have what the other lacks. Anybody got anything there? Go ahead. There, that fullness of relationship, and there's question whether or not the threefold's intended to bring in the divine side or intended to bring in other relationships as well. I don't know, because both can be, and that seems to be the idea, that when we reach out with others and when we care about them, then there's going to be that sense of a greater fullness in our life. You find somebody who's over here either themselves or a man and a woman who are a hermit all by themselves, don't have anybody else, what are they going to be like? They're going to be weirdos too. You know, it isn't just the guy by himself. It's going to be something that you have that kind of person as being somewhat of a recluse in those deals. They're not going to be ones that are living a life that's very fulfilling in that way. Tyler, you had something. Yeah, there's very clearly the companionship that can be there. The idea of two that are lying together to warm themselves seems to be, that's usually the case of in the bed. You know, that's a reference to marriage. But that is so with other friendships or relationships as well. When the Proverbs come up, and we're going to go through a kind of a survey of the Proverbs next after we get through of Ecclesiastes. But the Proverbs talk about the need for there to be a multitude of counselors as well. And the idea is it gives wisdom. When we're seeking out the viewpoint and the help of others, we're not going to just act in a rash way on our own thinking. We're going to have that considered with people who have some wisdom that is involved. That's the idea too, in the sense of that kind of advice that would be pointed out. Verse 13, this is one that admittedly is the most difficult part of this particular chapter. Better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. For he comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. I saw all the living who walked under the sun, and they were with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king, yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Look at your questions. I asked you about that one. Before we discuss it, see who's brave here. Express in your own words, number 7, the situation described by Solomon in verses 13 to 16. Larry's got it.
I put down that a wise youth has followers and a foolish king has no admirers.
Okay. Anybody else? Oh, come on. Get on out there. Put your foot in the water. Let's go. Anybody want to try it?
Marie had her hand up.
We don't volunteer others, Mike. I want you to think about something, okay? Get those wheels turning. Better is a poor, wise youth than an old, foolish king who will be admonished no more, who will not receive rebuke. Do you remember a king that was young and acting more wise than an older king who at first was a good king, but then he started to rebel against God and he wouldn't receive admonition? Okay, Saul and David. I think that's probably what he's starting out here in that particular point, is talking about here's a poor, wise youth. Well, David was that shepherd boy. That's not the craft of one who is very wealthy. And he was seen to be ruddy and all of those things, yet he had a wisdom that was there. Saul was trying to kill him, right? He escaped, dwelt caves and various things like that. In a way, that's a sense figuratively of a prison kind of a sense like that. That you have this youth against a king who would not be admonished. Now that youth comes out of prison to be king, even though he was born as a poor one. And what happened? I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. Now, here's the question. What's the second youth? Is that talking about that boy back up there at the start? I think it is. Look why. Verse 13, the latter part of it. That poor wise youth is better than an old foolish king who will be admonished what? No more. What does that mean? No more. That implies what? He was before. What was Saul? Was he admonished before? Yes. He was a good king. He found himself as being one unworthy. He's son of Kish, a Benjamite, a lesser of the tribes, and therefore he saw himself as not worthy to be that. Yet later he became an old and foolish king and would not any longer be admonished. Now what happened? Here was that first youth. Saul, when he was a youth, was before David being a youth. David in his youth would come after Saul in his youth. And so he is that second youth, I think. The word that's used in the Hebrew is one of two. And it's an idiom that's there. And it can mean several things. It can mean either the first in order, or the first that you were talking about, or the first in the sense of one of the two, not giving an order. It's an idiomatic use. It's difficult to determine in Hebrew sometimes just exactly what's being referred to. But with each of those uses, it would have been different by the spoken word. That's why Hebrew many times was intended to be spoken, to give the people the law and so forth. It has a kind of a sing-song effect. And that saying of it, the emphasis, would give you that difference as to who it was by the inflection being on the same one. What I think is happening is that you deal with David just as a conception that Solomon is talking about. Here's this one, this second youth who comes along, the poor wise youth that's there. He stands in his place, in the place of the first king, who's Saul. Says there was no end of all the people over whom he was made king. In other words, he's over the whole of Israel in that way. And as a matter of fact, that kingdom expanded during the time of David. It reached its ultimate boundary and stayed that way through the time of Solomon. Yet, those who come afterward, what? Will not rejoice in him. That's an interesting word, too. Because it doesn't just mean hip, hip, hooray kind of rejoicing. They will not exult with him. In other words, they will not see what David did to be a wise king and be someone wise like he was. After you have Saul, David, Solomon, then what do you have? Rehoboam, Abijah, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Jehoram. You go right down the line, and what do you see? A lack of wisdom. If you're going to look at the kings that follow, especially the kings of Judah that are following the house of David, then what you're going to see is vastly more foolish ones than ones who are wise. Why? They had a written down record that was given to them of David and his wisdom and how he tried to do what was right. Why did they not follow that? What'd they do with the law many times? What happened to it?
Got lost.
And with that, the history that was there and so forth as well, they didn't care for it. As a result of that, they came to be the fools that Saul really was in his life and rebelled against God. When you have such a good start as Saul did in the humility, in the striving to be what God would have him to be, and the recognition of the lack of power he had in himself, When you have him like that and then end up like he did, you have a good illustration of what you should not be as a king. If the kings would have read their history and the law, they would have done what God intended for them to do. They would have told the people, look, this is how we need to live. This is the right way. And they had all the tools to do that. And yet what we find predominantly in their history is they turned away from that. What can you call that but folly? I mean, you can't look at that and say anything else except that here are people who just didn't care about going back and seeking the wisdom of God and what he had talked about. Anybody else got anything yet there? Exactly. He goes on, let me get to this real quick before we end. Yet those who come afterward were not rejoicing in him, as we said. Surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. There is a sense of this that maybe we haven't come up with just exactly before, and that is, here's someone who before was seeking wisdom, as we just noted, in what David did, what he's looking to God. And then there's another one that leaves that wisdom and he goes unto himself. People are following along to that king, but afterwards, what do? They forget what he was like. And instead of them being the ones that seek for righteousness and try to get the king to go back to that way, they've forgotten all about that righteous king. If you look at the history of Judah, that's what you see. The times when they went back to what was right, it was a strong king who himself had a desire to serve the Lord. You do not get it from the people trying to impose it upon the leader. That typically doesn't happen, but it ought to. Now, when you look at that too, I want to look at the difference there. Here's this person in his youth, like Saul. He was a good man, humble, seeking the things of God. And yet, in his older years, what did he become? What did he become?
He didn't listen.
All right, he didn't listen. What's the word God uses again and again? All right, rebellion. That sense of disobedience that God talks about him. The rebellion is that I'm going to do it my way. He was had his self guided by himself. This is something that I notice as you observe life. A lot of times somebody in their youth who's going to be a servant of the Lord especially is going to work real hard. They're going to serve the Lord. They're going to study. They're going to grow. And then they get older and somehow they think they know it all. I can't for the life of me figure out how somebody comes to that, because if they're studying, they've got to recognize what I find out every year is how much I don't know. And there's that short time that I've got left to learn what I want to learn. But that's typical of age, is that you get tired of the work. You get tired of all of those things, and what happens? You start to slip spiritually. Now, what will keep me from doing that? Together with that hard work of trying to seek what God said, what was there with both Saul at the first and with David all throughout? A humility. a recognition that I'm nobody. And I need to have that sense of a humility that will direct me back. When a person gets older and that pride develops in them, they're going to be self-led rather than God-led. And there's a big difference between the two. They're going to think, well, I've done this all of this time. And as a result of that, what happens is they stop going back to the source. I don't know how many times I've seen people who are older, my age or more, who've been faithful Christians for a long, long time, and then all of a sudden, what happens is they go out into denominationalism or out into some apostasy or out into worldliness. And you think, how in the world did that happen? They're coming close to the time when they're going to meet the Lord. The answer that I think is there from what I see of people is the same thing that was there with Saul. He came to be content in himself, guiding himself, thought he had learned it, and so he was fine by himself, and they direct themselves in that way, and they don't go back to the Bible. Whenever we hear something, whatever it is, or whenever we think something, whatever it is, we need to do what? Check that by what saith the Scripture. You know, what is it there? Search the Scriptures daily to see what so. That's what has the answer, not ourselves. And that means we consistently have to go back to it and seek the guidance that's there from God all of our lives till the very last day. You had something.
Christianity has no early retirement.
That's right.
I mean, you're done when you die. And I've seen older people that kind of retire, and I understand they step back and say, let's let some of the youngers maybe lead singing, and then all of a sudden they're not doing anything, you know. And then I see other ones that, boy, they still want to step up and volunteer for the table, the prayers, the whatever it might be, until they're old, you know. They're not retiring early, and when you retire early, you know, you get weak.
Right. I think we have had a number of those who are older who've given good examples along that way. I think about Tom. I was sick, I don't know, probably a couple of months before Tom passed away, and he called me, you know, just like always, how you doing? And checking on people when they weren't there, that worked. It continued. And then, I think it was 3 weeks to the day before he died, he called and asked me, I want us to have a study on heaven. What the Bible says about heaven, just going through the deals. Others might come, but I want us to look at not what everybody thinks, but what does the Bible say about heaven? And that was the way he was. That was a good example for us. We've seen others like that as well. The idea is to maintain that sense of that poor, wise youth who's directed by the wisdom of God, directed by the wisdom that he's been taught. If he continues to go back to that, then there's going to be that wisdom that pervades. But if he does not, what's going to happen? Not only is he going to forget it and go astray, but what else is going to happen? Why did Paul warn in Acts chapter 20 to the elders at Ephesus, from among your own selves men shall arise speaking perverse doctrine? Why did he warn that? That's the ones who would have the most influence for going away. And so the idea is Satan's always going to try to get in where he can have the most influence. And if he can turn somebody who before has had a name or had a reputation, an example of one who's a godly person, well-studied, well-versed in Scripture, if he can turn them away from the truth, that's Satan's best ally, and that's what he's going to try to do. You and I need to make sure he doesn't do that with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think one of the saddest things I've ever seen is older Christians who are caught in the wrong, and they're real kind of proud about it and don't want to change, even though their errors pointed out.
Right.
I've seen that a few times.
That's for sure. And usually it's, well, I think, or I used to think that same way, but now I think. And that gets in there rather than, here's what the book says. And I'm nothing. God's everything. Let's keep our focus on his direction. That's the second one? Okay. All right. Well, we'll cut it off there and start with chapter 5 then next time. I was just about to get to the questions.